This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachel. The scientific search for true extraterrestrial life dates back more than 100 years. Scientists have found no concrete evidence of alien life, though many still believe in the unknown possibilities of outer space. And certainly pop culture in the form of TV and movies has reflected the hope that we're not alone.
What we have just heard are the first words of the inhabitants of another planet, a cosmic document.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Well, that is First Contact and what it sounded like to the producers of the first spaceship on Venus in 1960. And at this point, the Hollywood rendition is all we have. There has yet to be scientific confirmation of extraterrestrial life, but the search is on. Seth Shostak is a senior astronomer for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, or SETI. And he has spent a career looking for E.T. He's speaking at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh on Saturday and Sunday as part of Astronomy Days. By the way, we're going to take your calls today for Seth as well. If you have a question about the search for extraterrestrial life or have some opinions about it, you can tweet us at SOTET. You can send us an email at SOT@WNC.org or call us at 877-962-9862. Seth Shostak, welcome to the program. Good to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
You say we're going to find proof of aliens in the next 25 years, and given that we don't have much at all on the books, how are you so confident?
Well, indeed. It's a bit of a speculation, but it's based on the fact that the equipment that we're using to try and eavesdrop on signals from the aliens is improving very, very rapidly. It follows the trend in computer technology. So that's very predictable. And, you know, nobody knows how many aliens might be out there. But if you look at what I think are reasonable guesses, they're called estimates, but that's a euphemism, then it works out that, you know, within the next 2 dozen years, we'll have looked at at enough star systems to my mind, ensure success. At least I'm willing to bet everybody a cup of coffee on that.
What are you listening for?
Well, we're just looking for the kind of signal that a transmitter makes. I mean, you know, nobody knows what the aliens might be saying or how they're encoding their message or whatever. I mean, you know, it's like, going into the caves of some ancient civilization and hoping to find some writing somewhere. You don't know what the language is or how the written material has been composed, but it doesn't matter. You would recognize something as being writing even if you didn't understand it. So we're looking for a signal not made by quasars, pulsars, or any of those other natural noise emitters, but something that was made by a transmitter.
And you are listening kind of passively, but you're also assertively kind of looking for this stuff, sending out signals. Is that right?
Well, actually, it isn't, because we don't do that. We don't actually have transmitters. But there are people, including people here, by the way, who think that we ought to do, well, what your radio station does, and, you know, broadcast, actually, and solicit some replies. Other people think, oh, well, that might be a dangerous thing to do because it tells the aliens we're here, and how do you know they're friendly anyhow? So that's the subject of a big debate. Personally, I don't think that there's any real danger there. If you're really going to worry about that, then you ought to shut down the radars at the local airport, because they're broadcasting into space, as is this radio station. So I don't worry about the danger, but we are not doing that. Part of the problem there is, you know, you broadcast and maybe the nearest aliens are 500 light years away. It'll be 1,000 years before you hear back.
Well, and that's the other problem, I guess, for you. When you hear back, you might be hearing from an extinct civilization, right?
Well, it could be. I mean, let's say they are 500 light years away. And so you pick up a signal tonight and you say, well, I don't know, Bob, but, you know, that signal's 500 years old. That's how long it took to get here. Maybe they've gone extinct in the meantime. Well, you know, maybe, but I get letters from my relatives that take 3 days for the Postal Service to get them to me. And I seldom think about the fact that, well, maybe they've died in the meantime. I mean, they may have, but it's unlikely.
What is the scope of your search so far? How much have you already checked out?
Well, you know, I get the question all the time. You haven't found anything. And what's the explanation for that? Maybe we're the smartest things in the cosmos, something that, you know, many people I encounter like to believe. Well, we've looked at a few thousand star systems. A few thousand. Now, in our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, there are hundreds of billions of star systems. So to have looked at a few thousand isn't, you know, it's kind of early days to conclude from that very limited reconnaissance that there's nobody out there.
I'm going to go to the phones now. Ray is on the line from Greenville, and he has a question for us. Hello, Ray.
Hey, thanks for having me on here. I'm very excited about this topic. I guess I have just a thought and a question to pose to your expert there. It seems like to me, wouldn't it be more likely for there to be primitive life like microbes or primitive animals than intelligent life? I guess that's one of my questions. And the other question is, how can we detect non-intelligent life? You know, because we think of signals that will have to come from intelligent beings. Do we have to send robots or people to find things like microbes or microorganisms? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Ray.
Yeah, well, Ray raises a good point, and I certainly agree with him. I suspect that, if you will, life that you need a microscope to see, you know, non-intelligent life is undoubtedly going to be far more prevalent than the intelligent variety. And indeed, that's where all the effort is, or the majority of the effort. I mean, if you look at what NASA is doing, or the European Space Agency, or other space agencies, you know, they're all trying to find some sort of biology beyond Earth. And the way they will do it, mostly, is to, you know, build a rocket and send it to your favorite putative inhabited planet. I mean, Mars is always near the top of the list, but there are five other moons in the solar system that have liquids, we think, and they might have microbes too. So, you know, my colleagues down the hall here at the SETI Institute, 96% of them are looking for, if you will, microbial life. But, you know, Ray, let's be straight up about this. I think that if you were to take the next six people you encounter on the streets, you would find that the majority of them are more interested in finding aliens that can hold up their side of the conversation, the kind they see in the movies and on TV. And so that's a very small research effort. The total number of people in the world that do that is maybe a dozen. I happen to be one of those. So, you know, we're trying to find signals that would tell us somebody intelligent is out there, too, not just bacteria.
Right. But again, that does raise the sort of the question, the kind of the anthropocentric views that we have of what it must be to be intelligent life or what an intelligent creature would do. We think of intelligent creatures, fundamental to that is our willingness and need to communicate. There might be another form of advanced life that says, you know, that was our problem. I think we're just not going to do that anymore. And perhaps the key to their survival. I mean, it does seem that the options for the kind of life you're going to find tend to be limited in the sense that they're going to have some of the same instincts that we do.
Well, there's undoubtedly some anthropocentric bias there. I certainly agree with that. But on the other hand, you know, if their society has decided, you know, we're just going to lay low and not going to broadcast anything, well, we're simply not going to find those guys. I mean, just rule them out, right? The only ones you're going to find are the ones that have taken the trouble and taken the dare, if you consider it that, to broadcast into space, either, you know, deliberately or it's just an accidental byproduct of their culture. So, yeah, you know, there may be lots and lots of societies that aren't making any noise. You know, our definition of intelligence is very simple. It's it's kind of an operational definition. If you can build a radio transmitter, you're intelligent, and that's it. That's all we ask. They don't have to write poetry.
In terms of, again, the search or the likelihood, it's interesting to have this conversation with folks to find out how set people are in their ways. They often call themselves skeptics, but really they've made up their mind. There could not possibly be. What are sort of the odds? I mean, given the amount of material out there and the space that it occupies, is there any way that you've all computed the odds that there should be, might be, or could not possibly? Well, obviously you don't believe that. But the likelihood that there's life, some kind of life, just given how much stuff is out there.
Yeah, well, of course, there are plenty of unknowns in such a computation, so you really can't say for sure. But I would say this. What we now know, and by the way, this is something we didn't know 5 years ago, is that, you know, almost every star has planets. We didn't know that. The number of planets in the Milky Way galaxy is about a trillion. That's with a T. That's a big number. And we also have some idea what fraction of those planets are the kind that, you know, you might consider habitable, where you could have at least bacteria and maybe something a lot more clever than bacteria. And that may be the case in 1 out of 10 star systems. What that means is that the number of places where you might consider building condos or whatever you consider an evidence of life, you know, is roughly tens of billions in our galaxy alone, tens of billions. And the number of galaxies we can see is more than 100 billion, each with tens of billions of habitable worlds. Well, that's a lot of numbers. But the bottom line is this. The number of planets in the visible universe is more than the number of grains of dry sand on all the beaches of Earth, okay? So if you're one of those who like to think, you know what, this is the only grain of sand where anything interesting is happening, because I really feel that's true. Well, you're entitled to that opinion, but that makes you a believer in some sort of miracle.
What about the your confidence that you can distinguish between an intentional signal and all of the other kind of noise that's out there? We certainly know what a lot of the unintelligent stuff sounds like in terms of pulsars and all other kinds of radiation. But how confident are you that if you find a pattern that you haven't heard before, that that's it?
Well, I, you know, reasonably confident. It isn't a matter of patterns, by the way, because a lot of people say, well, what are you listening for? Is it, you know, the value of pi? Are they sending us prime numbers as they like to do in the movies and that kind of thing? Actually, it's none of that. We simply look for signals that are, if you will, what are called narrow band signals. In other words, they're at one spot on the radio dial, just like this program is, right? I mean, you got the whole FM dial there, but you're only going to find this station at one spot there. That's because this signal is being produced by a transmitter. But if it were being produced by a quasar, a pulsar, a hot gas, cold gas, all the things that make radio noise in space, well, it would be all over the dial. It would just be everywhere. So if you find a signal that's not everywhere, that it's localized on the radio dial, then you can say, you know, we don't know what they look like. We don't know what they're saying. We don't even know much about how far away they are or anything like that. But we know they're clever enough to build a transmitter.
Once you find that signal, what's the next step? Is it locating it? Is it trying to translate it? I mean, what do you do next?
Yeah, well, the kind of equipment that's used for this experiment actually doesn't really allow you to pick up the message unless it's a very, very slow message. That's a matter of technology and trying to maximize your sensitivity. But if you get a signal, and by the way, we've had some false alarms, so we know how this works. What actually happens is you spend every effort. You just don't go to sleep until you have arranged to try and check out the signal to make sure that you're not being fooled. I mean, this isn't a North Carolina State undergraduate prank. This is a real signal. And in order to do that, you probably need to bring in people from other observatories and have them look at the signal. Meanwhile, while you're trying to do this, while you're trying to confirm whether you really have found the big one, the media are calling you. That's our experience. So they start calling right away.
Well, but that also leads to another issue that I'm sure you've had to deal with, and that is the way in which, stories like in Roswell or Area 51, they kind of take on a life of their own and then in some ways cast doubt on any possibility of extraterrestrial life because, you know, if you just choose not to believe in what's going on there and you think it's some kind of hokum, everything gets thrown into the same pot. Do you find yourself having to sort of distinguish yourself from other kinds of rumors?
Well, I certainly get phone calls or emails every day from people who think that the aliens are here. That's a very widely held belief, if you will, because roughly one-third of the American public, and for that matter, one-third of the public in Europe, Japan, Australia, whatever, one-third of the populace thinks that we're being visited, that some of the unidentified objects that are seen in the skies are actually alien craft. I think if that were true, if that evidence were good, to begin with, you would see that evidence in the science museums. But beyond that, you'd have many tens of thousands of researchers around the world beavering away on that problem, because after all, there's nothing that would be more interesting than the thought that we're being visited. That evidence, in my opinion, is very poor. If we were to pick up a signal, of course, you might choose not to believe us. There would undoubtedly be people who would choose to do that. But on the other hand, then, if it's confirmed by astronomers working in Australia and then working in Europe and so forth, I mean, it's completely independent groups, and they all find the same thing. And then you go into your backyard because you're kind of handy at this, and you build a big antenna, and you find the signal, too. I think that kind of evidence, I think that kind of punches through the noise, and eventually you accept that this is a real scientific result.
Let's go to Ralph on the line from Durham. Hello, Ralph.
Hi. I had a question about the cosmic microwave background radiation.
Sure.
I had read somewhere that it would be difficult to get signals off of Earth unless you were using a very powerful one, because after a certain amount of distance, the signal would just sort of like fade back into the cosmic microwave background. So is the reverse of that true? How do you filter out the cosmic microwave background when you're looking for signals coming from outer space?
Ooh, thanks, Ralph.
Yeah, well, Ralph, you're quite right. The cosmic microwave background is everywhere. and indeed, signals do get weaker with distance, just like, a beam from your flashlight gets weaker with distance. But on the other hand, if you have a big enough antenna, you can pick up a signal at any distance. And the cosmic microwave background You know, it's just a leftover glow of the Big Bang, if you will. That's reaching you from billions of light years away, and you can pick it up. You can pick it up with some equipment that'll fit on your desk. So, you know, you can do this, and the cosmic microwave background is a naturally produced radio noise. So that's all over the dial. So, you know, that doesn't influence us at all. We're not really very sensitive to that. We're looking for things that, as I mentioned earlier, are at one spot on the dial. So, you know, that kind of natural noise doesn't play much of a role.
Last July, Stephen Hawking and a Russian billionaire pledged $100 million over a 10-year period to enhance ET communications in new ways. What can this money do and allow us to do that we hadn't been able to do before?
Well, indeed, the Breakthrough Listen Initiative, as it's called, was funded by a gentleman by the name of Yuri Milner. And he actually gave that money to the University of California at Berkeley's SETI group. So that didn't come to the SETI Institute. But they're going to, you know, ramp up. I mean, that's a lot of money for this sort of thing. The big problem in SETI, when people ask me why haven't we found anything, I have to go into a talk about money because it's all just supported by people who, you know, mail us donations. But that money there for Berkeley, that's a lot of money for them. And they are building new equipment and they're renting time on big antennas and stuff like that. So they're going to make a very extensive search. And, you know, maybe they'll find something. I mean, that's the name of the game. This is like sailing into the South Pacific in 1770 or whatever, hoping to find some interesting islands you never knew about, or maybe Antarctica. Those are all things that could only be found by exploration, and that's what this is.
What are your personal beliefs? What do you think we're going to find out? And sort of how long have you been engaged in this kind of process of imagining life out there?
Well, I'm sure I was interested in aliens as a kid. Most kids are interested in aliens in the same way they're interested in dinosaurs, actually. So, you know, I've been interested for a long time, but what do I think we'll find? You know, just finding it would be so profoundly interesting that I don't worry too much about what they're saying. But if you ask me, what do I expect to be behind the microphone at the other end? It's probably not a little gray guy with big eyeballs and no hair. I think it's much more likely to be machine intelligence. And the reason I say that is simply because that's something we are likely to develop in this century. And once you have machine intelligence, it can very quickly outsmart any biological intelligence you have because it keeps designing its own successors. And so I think that just on the basis of these very simple arguments, if we pick up a signal next week, it's not going to be a soft, squishy, protoplasmic intelligence on the other side of the microphone. It's going to be some sort of machine.
So you think, and this is based on what an emailer is asking, that perhaps what we find out there would be could be based on a non-carbon-based life, something more. I mean, a silicon-based life form would be great. It's kind of stable. It's just it's hard to replicate itself. And so the great thing about organic molecules is that they're kind of shifty. They change, but they're stable. And silicon is very stable, so much so it can't replicate. Is that what you expect to find? Maybe somebody's figured out, some life form has figured out the stability of silicon and the joy of reproduction?
Well, silicon is the that's the element underneath carbon in the periodic table. So it shares a lot of carbon's chemical properties, but it's actually rather poor at making very complex molecules. Carbon is much better. If you're talking biology, my bet is it's probably carbon. Maybe under some circumstances, silicon would work better. The confusion here is that some people use silicon-based intelligence to refer to machines because many of our computer, most of our computers are silicon-based. The little transistors in there are silicon. Okay, fine. But that's not silicon biology. What I'm saying here is they won't be biological. They won't be life. They will be intelligence, but they won't be life.
Keep up the search. We're going to be happy to see you here and hear your talk. Seth Shostak, a senior astronomer at the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, or SETI. Thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Seth's going to be at Astronomy Days at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh on Saturday and Sunday, and we have details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we talk about the social life of DNA and why so many Americans are turning to genetic testing to learn about their ancestry. It's on the State of Things coming up. Stay tuned.